What's up, guys? Kevin Estella here with Fieldcraft Survival. I want to recognize some of our sponsors that make this podcast you're about to hear possible. First one is Sig Sauer. Sig Sauer is the leading name in the United States when it comes to firearms and training. Solid folks at the Sig Sauer Academy. I don't think they get enough credit. These dudes are awesome. These gals are awesome because let's not forget Hannah Billadoo, who's a total badass chica. She's over there along with all my good buddies from the Sig Sauer Academy. Guys, Sig makes some fantastic pistols. I've been playing around lately with the Sig M400 Tread, and that AR-15 platform, I mean, it's got great fit and finish, super accurate. I've let a bunch of students try it in courses. Very, very pleased with it, and I've never had an issue, knock on wood. The other gun that is one of my favorites that I travel with a lot is the Sig 365. The Sig 365 is a fantastic firearm in that it's a striker-fired pistol. That pistol is one that you can change into the small configuration or the large configuration, so the standard or the XL. You can go from a 10-round mag to a 15-round mag. You can do a lot with the 365 XL. And you can also put a weapon light on it, like the TLR 7 Sub, making it a great backwoods gun. So check that one out if you get a chance. And like I said, check out the Sig Sauer Academy. It's up in Epping, New Hampshire. If you go up there, stay at the Exeter Inn, eat at Goody Cole's, swing over to Kittery, go shopping over there. You can make a whole vacation out of going to the Sig Academy. And I'm excited to be up there this September. I'll be teaching Modern Survival Skills September 9th, which that class, as of this recording, is over halfway filled, and it will be a great time being up there for the first time as an instructor at the school where I train 20 something times. So really excited to be back up there. The other podcast sponsor I want to recognize is Vertex. Vertex has been in the game for a long time. I mean, I remember wearing Vertex pants at the Wilderness Learning Center in the early 2010s. And, you know, I still have Vertex pistol magazine pouches that I use when I go to the range just to keep all my stuff organized. And a bunch of the folks here carry various firearms in Vertex bags, which are designed to, you know, carry short-barreled rifles or pistol caliber carbines or pistols with suppressors on them. So guys, please check out vertex.com. They've got a whole line of clothing that, like I said, I've worn for many years. It's tough as nails. I still have a pair of Vertex pants that I wore on a pilot TV show that I was on back in like 2016, which, you know, required me to hike through the desert like 28 miles over 3 days. And I mean, I was dragging those pants over rocks and through briars and all sorts of crap. I still have pine sap in those pants from that trip. And yeah, they're lasting. So guys, check out Vertex when you get a chance. That's V-E-R-T-X. And see all the stuff that they have to offer. The last thing I'm going to say is please check out the classes that we have coming up. We are training all across the country. I will be in New Hampshire. I'm going to be in Connecticut. I'm going to be back in Utah. I'll be all over. So if you're looking for survival training, check it out. You can see where I'm going to be. And of course, I'm based here in North Carolina at our fire base out here. So please check us out in Aberdeen. If you know anyone in the Fayetteville area, Charlotte, we're less than 2 hours away. So come and check us out. All right, guys, it is time to get to this podcast. So here we go. Welcome to the Fieldcraft Survival Podcast. I am your host, Kevin Estella. Friedrich Nietzsche was a philosopher, and he said, if you have the why, you can endure any how. And that's a quote that's kind of stuck with me over the years. You know, my background is not in the military, but my background is teaching survival skills. And something that can be found in most survival manuals is this idea of positive mental attitude. And it's this idea of creating little victories and this idea of never forgetting your worth. And this idea of if someone could do it before you, you could do it as well. Well, in survival, it's often you against the environment. And there are stories of people who have had to endure and survive, not against just the environment, but against a captor, someone who has done some terrible things to their psyche, to their body, and so forth. And I am incredibly honored to do this podcast today with a gentleman who I highly respect, someone who wrote some incredible books, who endured insurmountable odds. And I'm sitting across from him right now, and it is an absolute pleasure and honor. And as a history guy, making sure I can record this oral history because it's so damn important. It's an honor to sit across from Lee Ellis. Lee, thank you so much for joining me on this podcast.
Thank you, Kevin. Great to be with you. I appreciate you doing podcasts on this area.
Well, I was not going to miss out on this opportunity. And after reading your book, I was like, this is incredible. We need to share some of the lessons, not just in resilience and not just in how you can kind of fortify your mind and your body towards, you know, adversity, but all you also speak about leadership and what you did over there showed incredible character. So let's just dive right into this. We're sitting currently at Randolph Air Force Base. Right around the corner from this office where we're podcasting is a wall, and there is a statue that's a smaller statue of the missing man formation in flight. Why are we here? Who are you? And let's get everyone caught up to speed on why this is so important.
Yes, we're at Randolph Air Force Base in San Antonio, Texas. I had three tours at this base and during my active duty time, but the first one was when we first came home. The POWs from the Air Force were all offered the opportunity to return to flying. Of course, being young and active and having been a fighter pilot, I was ready to go back into flying. I'd been looking forward to that. And so we all came here to get requalified over the period of the next year or two. Some of them went to school to a war college or a place like that and then came here. But I took my R&R, rest and recreation, and then came here. In the summer of 1973, I came home March the 14th, so as I was released. I came back to the U.S. on March the 17th and met my family and all. So we came here to fly again and get requalified. This is a T-38 instructor pilot training course in the squadron, the 560th. And that hallway out there outside has a lot of memorabilia and photographs of these pilots on their first flight, which was their champagne flight. Normally in combat, your last flight was your champagne flight. Well, we didn't get that because we got shot down and captured. So we got that on our first flight. And this squadron has had a reunion every year since. And we have a member of a small museum here where there's some clothes that POWs wore and things like that. So it's become kind of an anchor for the whole POW flyer movement in the Air Force here at Randolph Air Force Base.
So we're back here, or you're back here, to celebrate three gentlemen? Is it three? Or how many are coming back for their...
Well, three of them, there are only three left that haven't flown ever since they came home. For various reasons, they got into something other than flying. And they're going to fly tomorrow on a T-38 in a four-ship. Three of them will be in a four-ship. And they're going to go out and fly around and come back and land. And when they land, they'll be right outside the squadron here, parking there. And we'll be meeting them with a bottle of champagne each. And there'll be a lot of photography, getting their pictures made, celebrating. And there'll be a good crowd here to greet them and say, welcome back. You know, thank you for your service, and we're glad you're here.
Now, that's going to be their final flight, right? Like the champagne flight. Mm-hmm. And you said that you had one back in the 70s, right?
73 when I came home on my first flight after the war was over, yes.
And now let's talk about why you didn't have a proper one when you were shot down during the Vietnam War. So how did that happen? Can you kind of talk us through the day of, you know, you're out on the mission, you get shot down, just kind of go play by play and tell us what happened. Yeah.
So on the 7th of November, I was on my 53rd mission over North Vietnam. I had flown other interdiction missions over Laos, half dozen or a dozen, somewhere in there. They didn't count, so to speak. But when you've flown 100 missions over North Vietnam, you finished your tour and went home. Or you flew a 1 year, 12 months, in the South and Laos, and you could fly some over North Vietnam. But to go home early, earlier than a year, you had to fly 100 missions over North Vietnam because they were so much more dangerous. Mm-hmm. And they just came up with that number. Well, I was on my 53rd one over North Vietnam that day. Now, I'd been flying combat missions for about 4 months, so we flew fairly regularly. I'd flown mornings, afternoons, evenings, nighttime. We rotated schedules, so every couple of weeks you rotated and flew a different time of day. We were well-trained, highly qualified. I can't say that the theories and plans from Washington, D.C. were very sound. We didn't think they were because they were made by civilians who were politicians or business guys who knew nothing about winning a war. And I saw that very quickly when I got there, and I think most of us did. We were not fighting that war the way we should have to win it. But you're a good soldier, you do your duty. And so we did our duty. And as I said, I was on my 53rd mission. When we were attacking an anti-aircraft gun sight that was protecting a ferry. We'd blown up the bridge, but they had a ferry there. And they would bring out the ferry at dark and ferry the trucks across the road that were bringing all these ammunition and supplies down to the south and troops to the south. So the airplane blew up, and fortunately, we were very well trained, and I was able to execute almost immediately
the ejection,
mm-hmm. and get out of that airplane within a couple of seconds, which was interesting because
the fun of podcasting at an Air Force base, right?
Yeah, this is this phone they're making it over that.
That just adds the authenticity of the podcast, right? If you want, rip that thing out of the wall, right? I think you've earned it. He is actually ripping the cables out of the phone. This is amazing. if it happens, it happens.
I don't have good fingertips. It's an old style plug-in. So pull this one. Well, there we go. I can pull this one out. There we go.
That might fix it permanently.
Got them both.
Okay, so you executed the ejection.
Yes.
And before we got disrupted, like, can you just tell us, what does that ride feel like when you eject out of a jet?
It happens so fast, you don't know how it feels. You know, it all happens in tenths of seconds. Mm-hmm. When you pull that handle, you decide to eject. Means you can't fly any longer. Your airplane won't fly any longer. Mine had been blown up, was actually tumbling. And so you know that you pull that handle. There's one between your legs and the F4. And you just grab it and pull it up. And you want to be sitting up straight so your neck doesn't bend. And you there's one other one you can. They also have the capacity to pull it over your head. You can grab these two loops over your head and pull them. But very few people use that, because it just seemed more natural to sit up straight and pull it from between your legs. And when you pull that handle, it blows a cannon under you, seriously. And that explosion sends you sailing up a rail, the ejection seat, and will blow you about 60 feet in the air. And then if you're below in normal lower altitude conditions, not high altitude cruising, your parachute connector is attached to the seat. Well, when you blow about 60 feet in the air, it automatically has a man seat separator, and it pops and it pushes you one way and the seat the other way. And when the seat goes the other way, it pulls your parachute and it opens it right up. So all I did was pull the handle. The next thing I know, in about a second and a half, I am looking up and look at my parachute, and now I'm remembering the training. Okay, check your parachute, make sure it's all open, and then activate your beeper, and then start planning your landing. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And I did all that. But training, even though they were shooting at us on the ground like crazy, I wasn't paying any attention to that. I was just doing what I was trained to do. The training had really been good.
So now you eject out of your, it was an F4 Phantom, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You eject out of the F4 Phantom. You realize that the canopy is overhead. You hit the ground. And what's the first thing that you're thinking?
I want to do my parachute landing fall so I don't break my legs or anything. And we're trained on how to, like paratroopers are trained how to do a PLF. You hit 5 points, your feet, your calves, your thighs, your butt, and your back. And I hit them all, so I didn't have anything damaged there. But when you go up the rails, you have 18 to 20 Gs times
a,
so your head weighs 18 times whatever it weighs. So if your head weighs 30 pounds, you know, it could weigh 600 pounds. 20 times 30, is that right? Anyway, a lot. So you could strain your neck, and so you wanted to be sitting straight. Well, I had a cut through my lip. One of the straps evidently hit me. My lip was cut through. I had a big cut under my chin. I had a cut on the back of my head. But I didn't even notice those. You know, when you're in the heat of the battle like that, you don't notice that sort of thing. And the next day, that night and the next day, my neck was really sore and I could hardly raise my head. But I was actually, after that ejection, I was in really good shape overall. There was nothing seriously wounded or damaged in my body. So I was thinking, okay, how am I going to evade capture? Because I'm over enemy territory and the militia's all around here. How am I going to evade capture? So I pulled out my radio. I jumped in an old, disconnected the parachute, jumped into an old bomb crater that is there, pulled out my radio and called my wingman and said, hey, I'm on the ground. I'm just north of the river. Start strafing. I'm 200 meters north of the river. Start strafing at 300. Well, after the war, a couple of years later, after the war was over, I saw these guys and they said, well, we heard your radio call, but we decided we couldn't shoot that accurately. I said, very wise, because they captured me immediately.
Wow. And before your capture, I know you said in your book, you know, the best chance of escape was with that initial contact, right?
Yeah.
Firing two rounds over their head. And I found it interesting that you said that you had a revolver, right? And it was loaded with tracers.
Yeah. No, I had two tracers. I had an empty hole under the hammer of the revolver, so it wouldn't go off. So all I had to do was pull the hammer back, and it would cock in that tracer. I had two tracers and three ball, you know, ammo for combat type.
And that was the best chance of evading. Like, they didn't want the contact. They didn't want anyone to, like, there was less of a likelihood of a larger force finding you, right? Was that the idea?
Well, at that time, there was just three or four militia guys in sight.
Mm-hmm.
They just popped up from around the bushes. And I thought, well, they said the militias, probably that's the best time to get away.
Gotcha.
They're the least trained. So I fired off a round or two of that tracer right over their head and motioned for them to get back. I didn't want to start shooting at them because I figured they'd kill me before that. And they didn't flinch. They just raised their rifles, and one of them pulled out a little pointy talkie, which is like a little fold-up card, in his pocket, and he pulled it out. And on one side, it's got a drawing of a pilot with his helmet on, with his hands over his head. And on the other side, it has phonetics, in Vietnamese phonetics. And this guy says, hands up, hands up. Hands up, no die. Surrender, no die. And I decided that was probably wise. I went hands up, threw away my revolver and went hands up.
That's incredible. So now, when we were talking in the hallway, you said that it took quite some time for you to get transferred further north to where you're ultimately held in captivity. And was it Vin? Where you said, what was the name of
Ben was kind of the halfway.
The halfway
really
point.
Wasn't halfway, but it was a holding session there. They had an old bamboo barn there with prison cells in it where they would lock guys up and they would hang on to them for a week or so until they got more. And then they would put them in a truck, in the back of a truck with guards, and you're handcuffed and your legs are tied and you're wearing a blindfold. And then we would go north to Hanoi. And it took about 3 days to get to Ben and then 3 or 4 days to get to Hanoi. Now, Ben is a long ways from Hanoi, but from there, there was less bombing and the roads were much better. And so we could move a lot faster.
The people that were your captors in that transition time, were they necessarily taking care of you or were they just concerned with moving you like cargo, like get them to, like get you and your fellow, you know, POWs, get you to Hanoi as quickly as they could? Like, did you notice that there was a difference in the way that they treated you versus the actual
captors? This particular case, there was. I was probably the most blessed or most lucky, however you want to look at it, of all the POWs I know, in that the militia guy that was actually in charge of getting me up to Ben was a really good soldier and a good person, a person of good character. And so he and his soldiers, he would not let the locals beat me up with their sticks and rocks and everything. They would push them back and move me out of the way and go hide me to keep me from getting beat up from those folks. And because the weather was so bad and the roads had been blown up, we had to wait there for 3 nights. And he took me to his home, an underground shelter that had been dug into the sand dunes near the ocean. And his wife and his father and his 2-year-old daughter were in this cave. It was just a cave in the sand dunes. And they fed me. And recently, a guy who lived about 20 miles away and knows a lot of the pilots that have been back over there, I talked to him and he went back and interviewed the guy's wife who'd captured me or was responsible for taking me north. He said, "Oh yes, I remember him. He had eyebrows that cooked all the way and he smiled and he did not know how to eat with a," now she's speaking Vietnamese, but right. He had a video of it. And my friend translated for him. And he didn't know how to eat with chopsticks. So I found a spoon for him. And I actually slept between his father and his 2-year-old daughter on the sand on top of a nylon blanket type thing that covered the sand.
Wow.
It was unreal.
So you actually were receiving food and water on that transport north?
I was what?
Receiving food and water? Like, yes. they fed you?
Oh, yeah. They fed me twice a day, usually a little bowl of rice with a piece of fish on top, you know, something like that. And then, of course, later we had mostly soup and rice or soup and bread in the Hilton.
So now you get to the Hilton. Mm-hmm. And when did you know at that moment, this might be a while here? Like, they're not going to let us go. When did that reality set in?
At first, when we got to the Hanoi Hilton, it was 2 weeks later, November 22nd. And I went into a cell with 3 other guys, 6.5 by 7 foot cell. Now, this prison was a Bastille prison built by the French in downtown Hanoi in the 1890s. So the walls were about 14 inches thick, brick, rock, concrete, all that. And it was a maximum security prison part where we were in then. And day to day, initially, then you're just thinking about, I just got to handle today. And then after a few weeks, I started thinking about the political situation back home. And I said, well, President Johnson probably cannot get reelected. This was November, December 67, January 68. He probably can't get reelected unless he ends this war. So we're probably going to get out of here by next summer. And I'm going to go to the 68 Olympics in Mexico City to celebrate. Well, President Johnson decided not to run, and we stayed there. But that next summer, when it came, I said, well, I made it 6 months. I can make it another year. In the summer of 69, I said, well, I can make it 2 more years. It was really about 3.5 more. But wow. After a while, that became our life. That became our life. We're hoping and expecting someday we're going to go home, but this is a life that we have to live with in the POW camp.
At the onset of this podcast, we talked about that quote, or I mentioned that quote, you know, if you know the why, you can, or if you know the how, you can endure the why, or I already messed it up.
Yeah.
You know, if I, if I can, oh my gosh.
You know the why.
If you know the why, you can endure the how.
Yeah.
Wow. It's been a long day. I think, you know, we're losing cell phones and, you know, we're losing all sorts of stuff. So yeah, if you have the why, you can endure any how. All right. I got it straight.
Yeah.
One of the things that was very clear in your book was how you were able to stay so positive over there. And I thought it was comical when I was reading some of these things where you said how you had Lieutenant Clark Kent and you had Lieutenant Ben Casey, and you would joke back and forth with your fellow prisoners of war by sneezing, "Horseshit," you know, and you had these different ways that were little victories.
Yeah.
And they were so, so incremental, but it kept you moving forward.
Yeah.
Can you talk to that, like the importance of that?
Well, the first thing was that we didn't have any humor in the first couple of months because we were so, emotionally, we were just so shut down, I guess you would say, but fear was heavy there, so you're not emotionally shut down. And then after we kind of became our way of life and we've made it a month and we made it 2 months, well, maybe we're going to make it. It ain't going to be good. It ain't going to be easy, but we're probably going to make it. We're going to believe we're going to make it.
Mm-hmm.
And so as that happened, we started to have humor. And I'll tell you, you got to have humor to have good relationships and to have good a good mentality. You got to be able to laugh at things. And so we started working to make fun of them and sometimes ourselves, just to make fun of each other in a healthy way and to make fun of the enemy. And so one of the things, they didn't understand a lot about our culture. So we could pull their chain and they wouldn't know we were pulling their chain. The first thing that came about, their president and founder was Ho Chi Minh. And they would torture guys to read on the camp radio. Just every cell had a speaker in it. Of course, the communists must rely on propaganda because they can't live by truth, so they have to have propaganda. And so they would torture guys to read their propaganda on the radio. And this one guy read, President, instead of Ho Chi Minh, he said, "President Horseshit Men says so-and-so." And when he did, you could hear people laughing up and down the halls. And so that really cooked us all off to say, how can we pull their chain and laugh at it and show that you ain't got us yet, boy?
Yeah.
And
then what I found fascinating was that you developed different code that you changed so regularly,
mm-hmm.
tap codes. And perhaps the thing that I'm most fascinated by is the idea that you created like a sound suppression device by rolling a blanket,
yeah.
putting it against the wall, speaking through one side, and you couldn't hear it through the blanket, but you could hear it through the hole on the other side of the blanket against the wall.
14-inch wall.
Unbelievable.
Concrete or brick wall. Yeah. And the first time a guy next door to me was telling me about it, he called me up. And the way you call people up was shaving a haircut.
Mm.
And that way, they didn't know about shaving the haircut. So if they would take people out of a cell, they'd go in, the guard or the turnkey would go in there next door and try to tap on the wall and get you to tap. They would start tapping some stuff. Well, we wouldn't answer because if it didn't start out with a shaving the haircut, they'd go, and the guy on the other side would go, boom, boom. And now we know it's a friend, okay? So we'd start, well, this guy did a shaving the haircut and I went, boom, boom. And I put my ear to the wall and listen, and I hear somebody start talking. And he said, and he was trying to describe it to me. He said, I rolled my blanket up and put my face in it. And I was trying to picture that. I couldn't picture it. Okay. And I could hear him talking though. And finally I turned into my cellmates, three other guys in the cell. And I said, he's talking about rolling. And one of them said, let me listen to it. And he came over and put his ear and said, I think what he's saying is roll a blanket up and make a muffler out of it and put your head into it like a horse collar.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, picture a horse collar and put your face in it and tighten it up real well. And you could talk without yelling. You could talk right through a 14-inch wall. And we, all of a sudden, we had a totally new technology. It's like, wow, this is so much easier than just tapping on the wall.
Wow. And then in addition to that technology, you had the tap code, mm-hmm. which you changed regularly.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, we were talking about this prior to the podcast about how all of the memories of all of the POWs, like your minds were so sharp because that's what you could control, right? You could control what you remembered and how you talked. And I found it fascinating how you were practicing typing. Can we just talk about that quickly?
Yeah. A little bit later, after several years later, after they had stopped the torture because of the pressure from the American people, mainly the wives and families back home. But one day they had opened they started opening up the shutters on these windows in the cells. And I'm walking down the campground there, and I looked over back to my cell, and I look over as I get close, and my next door neighbor, there's a guy in that room, and he's sitting there with his folded up blanket in his lap, and he's typing away. Well, there's no typewriter. There's nothing there except he's just typing away. And I got back in my room and I started thinking about it, and I said, oh my gosh, he was practicing typing. That's brilliant. And so I sat down and started practicing typing, and every day I would practice typing, and my roommates did too. Well, guess what? 20 years later, when computers came out, Lee Ellis could actually type really well on the computer, even though I'd only had 1 year of typing in high school in the 10th grade, so I could be with some girls. That's the only reason I took typing. You know, guys didn't take typing much back then.
Man, we have to backtrack a little bit, because you brought up a point that I neglected to mention. So this whole time that you're there, the early years, the abuse is rampant. I mean, I remember your accounts of how they had to kind of conceal the injuries when they were doing video of the POWs to send back, right? Because they didn't want it to be known that the injuries were happening. What type of abuse was it? Was it closed hand strikes, open hand strike? Like how are people being abused? Like what was the common
way? It varied from physical abuse of being beaten, okay, to with fists, and guys behind you. If you were in interrogation, the guy behind you might just take his hand and slap your ears so hard it break your drums, or they might just hit you, or might take their one friend of mine, they took their AK-47 gun and just took the butt of it and hit him so hard in right below his head in the back of the neck that it broke his neck.
Oh my God.
Injured it for a long, long time. And now he's 82 years old and he's still alive and doing okay, but he didn't go back into flying because of that. Okay.
Wow.
And there was very little medical care. You know, very few people got any medical care. The only reason John McCain got medical care, and he probably would have died without it, was his father was the four-star admiral, commander of the Pacific. And so they figured if they could keep McCain alive, then they could use him to buy into as a blackmail almost against this commander of the Pacific Fleet. So, but it could be that. The other thing, though, they had ways to torture you. They could tie your wrists behind your back, and then they put a rope around your right above your elbows and tie that very, very tight, and then they would get you on the floor and stand on the other elbow and loop it over and start cinching it up until your elbows touch. Well, that tears your shoulders. There's no way you can do that without just tearing, you know, the muscles and tendons and all up in your shoulders. And it was terrible. And so then they would put you on your knees on the floor and lift your arms behind you over your head. We call that the pretzel, because your feet are tied, your hands are tied behind your back, and now there's a guy lifting you up from behind and one in front of you putting his foot on your head and pushing your head down. So it's just horrible. And then sometimes they would just run a rope between your arms and where their elbows are tied there, run right above that, and throw it over a beam and just lift you up. Wow. One of my cellmates was lifted up for 37 minutes. Hanging from a beam with both arms behind his back, and that's the only thing that's holding him up. Well, you can imagine how horrible that is. So it varied. And another way was a simple, my first torture was just a simple, get down on your knees, put your hands over the head against the wall, and stay there. Well, and of course, my hands are handcuffed and my legs are in leg irons, so I can't get up and walk around. And the guard would check on you every 5 or 8 minutes. Sometimes they'd stay there with you for hours. And if you got down off your knees, of course, after a while, your knees start to hurt and your back hurts and your arms hurt. then they would just come in and start kicking you and beating you and put you back up. You get back up, and then after a while, you fall back down, and they get you back up, and it just keeps going back and forth. God. Until finally I said, okay, I'll fill out your 3-page biography. Well, I did. And the only thing I put on it was that was accurate and true was my father's first and last name, so someday I could maybe write a letter home. Everything else on there was a lie. And when I did that, though, I laid there tied up, handcuffs and leg irons and blindfold in a filthy floor and cried like a baby because I was so ashamed I wasn't tough enough to beat him. And then later, when I get back to my cell, I found out, well, I was tougher than some people and not as tough as some others. But everybody had been through this. And they could make you do something, and they wouldn't let you die. So you had to stay smart enough and stop soon enough so that you could outsmart them and not give them anything.
Yeah, I feel terrible asking the question about the torture. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it needs to be recorded to let people know why it's so important that you came home eventually, why it's so important that you were not forgotten. And, you know, we cannot just say, well, there was torture and just gloss over it. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you need those details to stand the test of time.
Yeah.
You also mentioned that the torture stopped or wasn't as bad because of the efforts of the women and the families at home, which you think about it, and I've thought about this, and I know that when I was a high school history teacher, my students thought about it. They said, could you imagine knowing that you had a loved one overseas, that they were alive, and given the time difference, like at certain times, they were probably looking up at the stars, but like you didn't know what they were going through. Were they being fed? Were they being hit? Were they getting sleep? Were they healthy? And the unknown was the torture that the families at home had to suffer.
Yes.
So how did that work with the families where the families were able to help you? Like, where did they apply the pressure?
After a couple of years, they were told by the DOD, which was told by the State Department, to tell the DOD to keep quiet so that we can negotiate. We don't want to make them look bad, so they'll negotiate. Well, communists don't negotiate for good reason. They negotiate only because the pain or the pressure is so strong, they're afraid not to negotiate. Mm-hmm. So it was just so hard for the women back home, especially the wives raising families. And finally they said, we're not going to keep quiet anymore. We've waited 2 years. And Admiral Stockdale, Commander Stockdale, then his wife was one of the first to get this going out in San Diego, where there are a lot of wives around there. And she kind of got organized, and then she contacted some ladies up in the other naval bases where they had aviation. And they kind of got to talking and got going, and then the Air Force got involved and some of the wives there. And so they started out as the League of Wives, and then shortly thereafter it became the League of Wives and Families, the National League of Wives and Families. And they stood up, and the new president came in, President Nixon, and Secretary Layard especially. He said, we're going to change the policy to go public. And then they started putting pressure on the communists about our treatment, because they had signed the Geneva Conventions, which required them to tell who is a prisoner, who's not, and to treat us with lenient, humane treatment. And they weren't doing either one. And so they started putting the pressure on them to do that. And then Ross Perot got involved and helped a lot of the wives fly to Paris, where the Paris peace talks were going on for years. The peace talks went on. The communists weren't really interested in peace, but they wanted the PR of being at the peace talks. And these women went over there and confronted them. And some of these women were so shy. One woman, she was so shy, she was a French major, and she couldn't even stand up in front of the class and teach French. But she became the president of the National League of Families for the state of Virginia and raised 750,000 letters to the communists in Paris and took them over in bags and dumped them out over there and got PR, see? And all this PR started all of a sudden to make them look bad, and that's why eventually our treatment changed, because Ho Chi Minh died, and a few weeks later the new leadership told the camp commanders, no more torture.
You know, in your book, you talk about the concept of leaning into the pain.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, you could think of it as those wives and those families, they knew that they were taking a major risk by doing that. They mm-hmm. could potentially bring on more torture for their loved ones.
That's right.
They could potentially bring on pressure from back home, their neighbor saying, why are you doing this? You're not helping my husband or my brother or whoever. Yeah. But they leaned into that pain.
Yeah.
Just like you guys were leaning into the pain.
Yeah.
And I think that concept, I mean, I don't want to shift too much, but that's such an important concept for survival, such an important concept for leadership. I just want to hear your short version of what leaning into the pain means to you and why we should all lean into pain.
Because we're all going to go through situations in our life where we suffer, where we have pain, emotional pain, physical pain, whatever. And we have to learn to do our duty, do what we know is wise, and get through it. And when we do that, quite often, we'll have people come and help us. In a POW camp, we helped each other. We would risk our lives to get to a cell where somebody had been tortured or was alone and living in solitary confinement and say, man, we're proud of you. We're not leaving here without you. And the women back home were started to connect and do that very same thing. And that made a huge difference. You know, the leaning into the pain is a very powerful thing. I had a cellmate who was brilliant. The guy IQ is over 160, I'm sure. It was incredibly. He quoted a poem that was read by Robert Frost at JFK's inauguration in 1960. He quoted that poem, okay? And he knew a lot of things he could quote. But he used to look at me at bedtime some nights, and he would kind of smile and say, Lee, because my name is Leon, but I go by Lee. He'd say, Lee, remember, pain purifies. And I'd say, okay, Jim, you're right. So, you know, there's just a lot of evidence out there that suffering will make you stronger.
Mm-hmm.
There's a great quote in the trailer from the Lord of the Rings trilogy. It's Return of the King. It's online. You can see it. There's no victory without loss. I can't remember the second line. The third line is there's no glory without suffering.
I'm looking for it right now.
Yeah. There's no victory without loss. There's no. Oh my! It's not because I'm old now, okay? It's because I've been so busy and there's so much information coming at us every day. I just can't remember that second line or first line anymore, but those are the two.
Is it this one? There is no victory without battle, no testimony without a test. No?
Mm-mm.
Oh my gosh.
I have it on a slide. Anyway.
Oh, hold on. I think I found it here.
All right, good.
I think we were both having one of those days. We both talked about not sleeping very well. And like I said, we've been losing phones and it is what it is. Now, if I could just get the Air Force Wi-Fi to pull up. Here we go. And of course, they only give me the first part. No victory without suffering, but they don't give me the rest on this. But in any case, I agree with you 100%. The idea of like, you know, forging, you know, we talk about forging and forging is hot and there's pressure and it removes impurities. And forging can be painful, right? Like we can forge ourselves through going through the gym or forge ourselves through putting ourselves through activities like going to run, you know, mm-hmm. and getting better lungs. Leaning into the pain, like you were talking about, makes you a stronger person. And in the case of those families leaned into the pain and got you better treatment, which is incredible.
Yes.
And I remember in your book, you mentioned that you noticed that the treatment was getting better and you knew that there was an end and there was one battle, right? Or one campaign that kind of turned the tides. If I remember correctly in your book, like, was there one air campaign?
You mean at the very end of the war?
Yes.
Oh yeah. The Linebacker 2 operation.
Yes.
Was a bombing campaign, 11 days long, in December 1972. Now, the negotiations in 72 picked up and got more serious, but then the communists kind of backed out in October, November, and so Nixon told them to go after them. And so they sent B-52s in there to Hanoi night and day, 24 hours a day, they were in there bombing, to the point that the North Vietnamese ran out of anti-aircraft artillery shells and out of surface-to-air missiles. And so after about the 10th day, they couldn't even fight back hardly. And so that's when they agreed to the Paris Peace Agreement that we ended up with. And that's when, shortly thereafter, that was like the 30th of December. And then they finally actually signed the agreement on the 23rd of January.
Wow. So now, 23rd of January, the agreement is signed. When do you know, like, when do you feel it in your heart, we're going home?
They were required by the, they knew it was going to probably be coming to an end, because like the 16th or 17th of January, they took 205 of us, which was about half of the long-term POWs. They had moved to the Chinese border when Linebacker 1 started on Mother's Day of 1972. And they brought us back and put us in camps based on our capture date. Well, that alerted us. And now they're treating us like nice guys, you know. Mm-hmm. And that alerted us that probably we're getting close to the end. And then when the agreement was signed, they had to notify us and give us a copy of the protocol or part of the agreement that talked about the release of POWs. And basically they said, over the next 60 days, all POWs will be released in order of shoot down and capture with sick and wounded first, and then you'll be released in the order that you were captured. And that's kind of what happened.
And just in the other room from where we are here, there is a display of the outfit that you were given. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming they let you, you know, shave, cut your hair, that type of thing. What was that sensation like? I know you mentioned it in your book where they came over the loudspeaker, right? And they said, you know, we're now in international waters.
Yeah. Well, first of all, we by this time, we were pretty emotionally flat. We don't get excited about anything until it happens, okay? Because we knew the communists might back up and say, well, we're not going to do that anymore or whatever. So we were not going to get excited. When they read us that Paris Peace Accord and told us the war was over and we're going to go home, we just stood there and looked around at each other and said, okay, we'll wait and see. And sure enough, the day we went home, we got on that C-141, the Air Force flew into Gia Lam Airport in Hanoi, and we went in about 40 people in each C-141. There were three of them that day. And when we broke ground, the airplane got airborne. You could feel the wheels crunch and start folding up to go in. And we started cheering. And then we settled down, and then a few minutes later, we were over international water, and the pilot came on and said, we're now over international waters. And we just started screaming. You know, we knew we were free.
That's incredible.
Yeah. And it took us about 2.5-3 hours to fly over to the Philippines, to Clark Air Base, and that's where the largest hospital, American hospital in the Far East was, military. And so we went there, and they met us, and there was a crowd waiting for us, cheering, and we had no idea that was going to happen. And we got on a bus and went to the hospital, and they handed us the hospital pajamas and a robe. So we immediately pulled off these clothes we got that morning. They told us to go down to a room in the camp there and pick out some clothes, in which we did. And anyway, so we went down and changed clothes, and then we said, okay. And they said, the cafeteria is waiting on you. Because you imagine all those years of waiting for a real meal, because you're eating two bowls of soup a day, one in the morning, one in the afternoon, with a cup of rice or a piece of bread. And we went down there, and some people were worried about whether we could eat this or that. One of my buddies ate 2 dozen eggs and a piece of steak and then some apple pie and ice cream. I ate probably 4 or 5 or 6 eggs and a steak and some ice cream and some pie for that meal.
Wow.
That was about 5:30 or 6 in the afternoon.
Do you have any estimation of how much weight you lost the whole time that you were in captivity?
I would say I normally would weigh in about 155 to 60. And that's what I weighed in high school. That's what I weighed in college. And that's what I weighed about 155 there. And when I came home, I was back to 145 to 150. But I'd say at one point I was probably 130, 135.
Wow.
Yeah. Skinny. But I'll tell you what, when you're that light, you can do more push-ups and chin-ups. And we started working out, you know, you got to have something to do. And so slowly we started working out and getting better and better. And I started out, I could only do 3 chin-ups. And within 2 years later, out at Sante, I could do 30 chin-ups and 15 pull-ups. And I would have never believed that, but it helped that I was very light.
So fast forwarding a little bit, you leave the Philippines and you eventually get back to the States and you eventually get reunited with your family.
Mm-hmm.
Who was the first person from your family that hugged you? And do you remember the words that were exchanged?
I really don't remember the words exchanged. My mom, obviously, and then my dad and my brother and his wife and their son, 3 years old, I'd never seen, of course. In some ways, I was so proud of them and what they had gone through and done, but I didn't know how to celebrate that much. We're emotionally pretty flat.
Mm-hmm.
After all those years, we had kind of flattened out our emotions. And that was probably a problem for a lot of us for several years. You know, guys that were married coming home, kids and all, they were probably fairly emotionally flat for a lot of things too. But I knew my family had been very faithful. Well, I wrote my first letter, a 6-line letter, after 2 years, and I got my first line, 6-line letter, 2.5 years. And then I get 3 or 4 letters a year like that, and I'd get to write out 3 or 4 letters a year like that. So I knew they were okay, and I knew they had done a good job, and I just had to show them that I appreciated them.
Wow.
I was a farm boy, you know, grew up on a farm, plowing mules. I went from plowing mules to flying supersonic jets in 5 years. But I was always driving tractors and cars and stuff, you know, a good risk taker. But we came home and I helped them. I had some money saved up and I helped them remodeling their farmhouse and a lot of stuff like that, and just stayed there with them a lot.
And then you continued your career in the Air Force.
Yeah, I did. Mm-hmm.
And how did you finish out the career? I know you were here and I know that you're on the wall over there. And, you know, can you kind of talk us through those final years?
Well, I had the first few years I was flying, I became an instructor pilot and just had a great experience there and had a great Air Force experience. Then I ran a leadership school. I was a vice ops officer and vice commandant at squadron officer school, where we had 5 classes, 800 per class, so 4,000 students a year that were the lieutenants and captains in the Air Force. It was a leadership school. And then I decided to step sideways and retire and went back to Georgia when the ROTC at the University of Georgia came open, Bulldogs. And I went back there. That's where I got my commission and ran that program. And I really enjoyed that a lot. I liked helping the young people develop.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess I've been helping people develop ever since. That was 1990 when I retired, and I've had my own leadership consulting and training company for 26 years. So I just like helping people become all they can be.
That's fantastic. I'd like to just take a few moments just to answer some of these questions.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And there are a few that really stood out. I reached out to the internet and I said, hey, if you could ask someone who stayed at the Hanoi Hilton against his will, you know, a question, what would you like to be? So I'm going to read a couple and I'll give you the papers and have you pick out a couple that you like. So this one comes from my friend Ashley Young. This is Jerry's wife. She says, what does a good day as a POW look like? Is that really stupid? Meaning, is there such a thing as a good day as a POW?
Yeah, we had some good days. And, you know, this became our way of life. When you're going through adversity, that becomes your way of life, and you got to make it positive into something I can gain out of this day. And so after the raid on the Sante camp in 1970, where I'd spent 2 years, we'd moved away, but there was a raid there, and they combined us all back into Hanoi into big cells where the Vietnamese prisoners had been. And we're in a cell with 52 guys for the next almost 2 years. And we had classes. We got organized. We had Monday, Wednesday, Friday classes, Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday classes. So I was studying French, Spanish, and German, teaching beginning French, studying differential calculus. And we would have movies, somebody tell a movie in the evening. We had Toastmasters on Tuesday and Thursday night. We had church every Sunday, and we had a great choir. So we got busy. We were so busy. We would go 8 weeks, and then we'd take 2 weeks off. Then we'd go 8 weeks and 2 weeks off. So, and we would do a lot of exercise. You know, I was walking on my hands. I could walk 30, 40 feet on my hands, doing vertical push-ups and stuff like that. And it was amazing that we got along so well. And I really, one of the most important things out of that POW experience was being locked up with other confident, somewhat, you know, over-the-top guys. We all became humble enough because you couldn't pretend. You couldn't be somebody that you weren't because 24 hours a day for years, they're living and watching you. And so we became more humble. We became more believing in each other. And so there were a lot of good days, you know. Mm-hmm. I learned 5 more Spanish words, 5 more German words today, you know.
So basically becoming better, a better version of yourself each day.
Absolutely. That became our goal.
This next question comes from A period Aaron period N underscore. We talked about this one earlier. If you met your captors today, mm-hmm. could you make peace? What would you talk about?
One of the things that we had time to do in those big rooms after the torture stop, when we were there together, we knew that if we went home with bitterness and anger and pain and shame, they were still going to have us in handcuffs and leg irons. Mm-hmm. It would imprison us. And so every day we tried to get rid of some of our bitterness and anger toward our enemy so that we could walk out. They were doing their job for their communist country. Now, we hate communism, okay? But we didn't hate the people there. And almost without exception, every POW I know does not hate their captors. And we all have great relationship with Vietnamese people, so North and South Vietnam. So we have very close friends that are Vietnamese. But there were a few of the torturers that were psychologically crazy. And some of the guys still hate them because they suffered so much. But other than that, nobody hates them.
This next question comes from EDC Dallas. And this is a broad question. One piece of life advice you came home with.
You have to have a clear set of values and beliefs about your character and who you are. And then you have to be willing to take risk or to suffer to be that person that you want to be. And that really takes courage. You cannot be the person you want to be without courage. And you have to grow to the point where you're so comfortable with who you are that when you mess up, you own it. You don't try to hide it. So many of our politicians, because of the media and all, they mess up. They try to hide it and deny it. And leaders, I mean, you know, in the first chapter of my Engage with Honor book, I spend a whole chapter talking about business, government, high school students, high school teachers, all who violated ethics and character because they're trying to do something that they can get ahead with, but then they get caught and then they want to deny it. And I say, you got to live naked. When you mess up, do your best. And when you mess up and fall short, just take on it, ownership for it, and grow as a person. So it's your character and values, your courage, and also your commitments. What's your purpose in life? What's your mission? And are you really committed to it?
Wow, that is powerful. And I love the idea of having those clear set of values and not straying from them. Because, you know, it's so easy to say, well, I'm going to believe in this idea and believe in that idea and believe in this idea and believe in that idea. But if you just have a few core words that you follow, words that you hold true, like I embody this, mm-hmm. it's so easy to live by it.
Yeah.
You know, and a word that means so much to me is integrity.
Yeah.
You know, and it's the idea that much like what you did, where you stayed true to your values and you came back with honor, right? Honor is a word that you were not going to compromise right. on, and that you had integrity in that word. If we live by certain words, we live a very good life. And I think you just summed it up better than anyone I've ever heard. Yeah, go ahead.
Let me just say, you know, initially our leaders, for one thing, you got to remember, we had great leaders. They were the ones tortured the most, suffered the most, and they're the longest. And their example for me really helped me become the person I am today. Their courageous example was so powerful. So if you're a leader, you got to know that people are watching you. Mm-hmm. And if you do something good, they're going to see that and they're going to say, I want to be like that. Okay, that's what we did. So a few years ago, but our motto was resist, survive, and return with honor. Well, after we had resisted and survived for several years, we dropped that and it just became return with honor. So in fact, there's a great video came out in 1998 hosted by Tom Hanks, Return with Honor. But the other thing is a few years ago, I and my team developed the Honor Code. And there's 7 articles on it. It's a free download in color. And the one, we had them all around the circle. And about after a couple of years, we said, no, we got to put courage in the middle. Because without courage, you can't do all these other 6. Mm-hmm. So it's a free download at leadingwithhonor.com. It's called the Honor Code. You can look it up and go there and download that. And it's a one pager. It's frameable and all that. So it's a really good thing. And I wanted to mention also, you've mentioned several of my books, but I'm working on a new one. In fact, I just found out it's going to be released on May the 30th. It's now on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the book places you can buy a book. But it's called Captured by Love, Inspiring True Romance Stories from Vietnam POWs. Now, we have 20 stories of guys who are POWs for longer than 5 years. 2 were married and POWs for 8 years. And their stories are in there, how their wives waited on them and raised their kids for them and all this. But it also goes into detail on the story of what the wives did and how they did it so courageously. And we have historical highlights in there between each chapter where it talks about what the wives are doing, but also the POW torture and what the POW camps were like. These are little one-pagers, the historical highlights. And I just think that people will really learn a lot and enjoy not just the love lessons, but just how we work together and as POWs and how the wives work together and how all that helped us to have great romance and marriage when we came home. Yeah. So you can go check it out now. It's at POWromance.com.
Yeah,
real simple. POWromance.com.
That's going to be a great one to read.
Yeah.
You know, we're wrapping up here, and you know, one of the things that I used to talk about as a teacher was the tragic history of how many Vietnam veterans, when they came back from the war, it was a very politically charged war, and people protested. And my late mentor was a Vietnam veteran, mm-hmm. and I remember asking Marty one time. I said, "Hey, I know that many of your brothers in arms will still meet each other with the term welcome home." Mm-hmm. And I said, "Is that exclusive between veteran to veteran?" He goes, "I'm happy to hear it from anyone that will acknowledge it." Mm-hmm. So all I want to say is welcome home. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And what we say to veterans every time we get a chance is welcome home. And the POWs were welcomed home. Because of what the wives and families did, mm-hmm. they put a lot of information out there, and people say, "Yeah, those guys are being tortured," and so people were welcoming us home. And but most soldiers who came home, they did not meet with a welcome. They met with being spit on and disdained, and some places they told them don't even wear a uniform because you might get attacked because of the political climate and the anti-war climate that was going on.
It's terrible.
Yeah. Welcome now, home, buddies.
So Lee, where can people find you? Where can they read more about you? They can reach out to you if they know someone who, you know, needs to take some leadership advice. Where can people find more of your wisdom?
Yeah, we have a great website, leadingwithhonor.com, and there's just a lot of information on there. And I do a monthly 5-minute, 6-minute coaching video for leadership. But most of the lessons that we talk about and the lessons in my book, they're just lessons for being a good person and being a good leader, being a good teammate, being a good parent. So a lot of good stuff on there with the monthly blog and video, and then all sorts of free tools on there. We even have one on how to choose your political candidate.
Right.
And it doesn't favor any of the political candidate. It talks about character and integrity and, you know, that sort of thing.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for being with us here on the podcast, and thank you for your service, and thank you for getting this history out there, because it needs to be remembered.
Well, thank you, Kevin, for having me here today. And I feel like this message is one that I keep thinking about myself, because I'm an old man, but I coach myself every day on how to grow and be a better person. That's my goal, is to continue to grow and be a better person. So I appreciate you having me here to share that information.
It's our pleasure. Guys, thank you so much for listening to the Fieldcraft Survival Podcast. Until next time.